All right, Tom, this time for our book club, we are reading White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. Now, before we start to get into this, there was some pushback on this book. So we had asked the patrons to vote, and they voted on 4 books. And this book was the one that was chosen the most. And the pushback that we got from a couple of people, and this happened before when this book came up, was that this book in particular is written by a white woman. And the people who were saying that this we shouldn't read this book were saying basically that this is centering a conversation on white people again. So it's centering a race conversation on white people. And this should be centered on people of color and black people. So what we should be doing is reaching out and looking for works that are done by people of color that are about their experience. And I don't disagree with that assessment in theory, but I recognize the benefit of reading this book before we reached in and did exactly that, which is what I think we're going to do soon, not maybe next, but we are going to very soon in the next couple months read a book by a person of color about race. But this book, I think, is a great primer for approaching that. And I want to read a piece. This piece is from a discussion pamphlet that's handed out with a paper copy of the book. And so if you just give me a second, I'm going to read this really quickly. I'm not going to read it all the way through, but I am going to read parts of this. And this is from page 6 of the discussion piece on the book. It says, as DiAngelo notes, white people addressing white fragility surfaces several dilemmas. First, it requires that white people be centered in a conversation about racism. This can be problematic because it reinforces the white centering that is taken for granted in our society at large. In parentheses, it says, it's the author's hope, however, that this is a centering that exposes rather than protects the workings of white supremacy. Second, it positions white people yet again as experts. Based on these dilemmas, the following points are important to keep in mind. One, the book and its arguments build on anti-racism scholarship and activism that people of color have written for generations. That scholarship has been fundamental to the ability of the author to explicate white fragility. Use this text as a starting point rather than an ending point to educate yourself on racism. Point two, the primary goal for white people working to understand racism is not to learn how racism impacts people of color. The primary goal is to recognize how the system of racism shapes our lives and how we uphold that system and how we might interrupt it. And then point three, for people of color, multiracial and indigenous peoples who are part of an informal or formal discussion group, the book and this guide will hopefully validate your lived experiences and offer some helpful insight into the challenges of trying to talk to white people about racism. So I think that piece right there sort of encapsulates why this book, I think, is really important to read before we go into that next step of reading someone who's a person of color who's talking about their experiences.
Yeah, I one of the things that this book, I think, does very, very well is it turns the table. White people have a tendency, and I think culturally this is very much reinforced, to say that when we're talking about race, what we're talking about is people of color. And what this book does a great job of pointing out is that, no, when we are talking about race, we are talking about race. And white people are a race, and they are white supremacy is inextricably linked. My whiteness is inextricable from the concept of a discussion about race. Any discussion of race doesn't have to center whiteness, but it should make me contend with my whiteness. I, as a white person, need to understand that my whiteness is not outside of the conversation about race, and that the conversation about race is about people of color's race. But that race is something that, like, my whiteness is absolutely a part of, and the white hegemonic power structure that I benefit from, regardless of my deeply held personal beliefs. And you can't pull those things apart. And trying to pretend that you can pull those things apart means that we miss the conversation. If we do all of our reading about race, only reading about not white people, that's a mistake for white people. White people have always felt that they were outside of race, that race is something. If you say, like, let's have a racial conversation, you should be able to say, let's have a racial conversation about white supremacy.
Yeah.
That is racial.
Yeah.
That is an absolutely racial conversation. Let's have a racial conversation about, like, what it means for a society to have structured all of its cultural defaults to be de facto good white. Like, let's have that conversation. I think this book does a really nice job of forcing white people to contend with their whiteness as part of the conversation of race.
And I also think, too, you know, there's a couple of things that that brings up. One is that, you know, this is a book by a white person addressing white people about white people problems. And to say what we need in this space instead is a person of color to navigate this space is insulting to the person of color, because these are our issues. These aren't their issues. They are the ones who are the object of these issues, but they're not the ones who are the perpetrators of these issues. And we should have to be able to fix those things on our own. And we shouldn't expect someone else to come in and yet again explain to us over and over, which has to happen all the time,
right,
why we're being racist or why we're being shitty. And so I think that that's, you know, one of the contentions, I think, was that, you know, we shouldn't be reading this book because we should be doing this other stuff and sort of reading like this, you know, someone's experience of racism affecting them. But instead, if we approach it as this is what we do so that we never have to even contend with that.
Yeah.
This is what we do so that we protect ourselves in these layers of white supremacy and these layers of passive aggressiveness that we do throughout to try to stop all conversations about race. If we recognize we're doing that, it'll make us more open when we do approach and we do reach out and try to read those things. It also makes a really good point, too, of distinguishing that it's not just big, scary racists that are racist,
yeah, yeah,
right? It's not just the KKK where we can all point and be like, it's just them. It's all of us, man. It's everybody. We all have racist tendencies. We all do racist shit. And the fact of the matter is that when, the more we recognize we're doing racist shit, the less we're going to do it because we recognize that we're perpetrating it all the time.
Yeah, I think if the criticism about reading White Fragility was that we should allow people of color to inform us of their personal experiences as people of color, I would 1000% agree with that. I think, though, that that is not the goal of White Fragility. The book is not to explain the effects of race on people of color. That conversation should come from a person of color. White Fragility's goal, as I understand it, is to get white people to force themselves to contend with their whiteness and the fact of their whiteness as a structural element in their lives.
Yeah.
And to your prior point, one of the chapters in this book is called The Good Bad Binary. And I think this is a brilliant chapter. I loved this chapter because when we talk about racism, most of us that like to think of ourselves as fairly progressive and fairly open-minded and liberal, and we try to think of ourselves in these sort of not racist terms, one of the reasons that we do that is because, one, we understand that there is a long-standing moral component to racism as it has been sort of cartoonishly defined.
Yeah.
And so what she describes is like, look, if we're saying that what racism is, you know, water hoses at lunch counters and Ku Klux Klan hoods, then yes, like I would agree that most of us are not racists, but that's not what racism really is her contention. What racism really is a system,
yeah,
of power and a system of narratives which constantly work to center whiteness as the de facto culturally preferred race. And we have to understand how that system and those narratives that constantly reinforce that centering of whiteness as inherently good and as the default and as the sort of default state of what a person is, and every other type of person is an adjective person, right? So like in America, we would say like, oh, I saw a man walking down the street, and we would assume that man is white. If we wanted to say that we saw a person of color walking down the street, we would put an adjective in front.
Sure. Yeah.
And the reason we do that in our language is because our language reflects the cultural value that whiteness is the de facto assumption of what it means to be human. So when we describe a generic human, we describe a generic human in non-racial terms, because, but it's still, what she's trying to get us to understand is that's still explicitly racial. Because when we say, I saw a man walking down the street, you wouldn't say that as a white person if you saw a black man walking down the street. You would say, I saw a black man walking down the street. Yeah. This is just an example.
Sure.
And so I think the book is doing a really good job, not of trying to say, here is the position that people of color have, but rather, this is something white people, as white people, we are not doing a good job contending with. We are lying to ourselves about it, and we are not doing a good job contending with these issues of race and how we continue to benefit from and perpetrate them, even as people who try in our like internal space not to think of ourselves as racists.
And in that chapter, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot in this book, I think, of shutting conversation down. I think that's the default mode of white supremacy, is to shut everything down. And you're not, I'm not, when I say white supremacy, I'm not saying like a fucking Ku Klux Klan rally or something. I'm saying like the mode of our society is white supremacy. Like we, like the whites have the primacy in everything. And so we have this thing where we constantly try to quiet conversation about race. And we actually don't even see our own race. We don't even consider ourselves racial at all until we're confronted with the idea that there are other races, and those are other. Those are the other, not us. Like you said, there's one race, and then all the other ones have an adjective. And I think like what's happening in this work is that she's constantly showing over and over all these little conversation shutdown points that people put in. And she lists them. And man, if you can't just go through and think, I've heard so many people say all of these things so many times throughout my life to quiet conversation about race and to stifle conversation and to stop conversation and to shift conversation to something that they're more comfortable talking about. I don't want to talk about this. Let's talk about gender, the real thing. Or I don't want to talk about this. Let's talk about class. This is the thing. And you know, it's amazing how much she pulls in this book of, you know, these little statements that you hear. And, you know, you might even hear yourself in some of these statements, because I know some of this part, it's very uncomfortable to listen to. Of the books that we've sort of read, this one is really uncomfortable. It was at least the first time I read it, because there's a natural part of you that wants to fight it a little. And I think like, you know, when you're hearing somebody say, yeah, I know you want to be a good person, but intention doesn't matter. Intention isn't the thing. It's the action. It's what you're doing to people. You know, you could have the greatest intentions in the world, but you can still be a fucking, you could still be doing shitty racist stuff.
I really appreciated, there are many moments in this book where she points out the subtle ways that our ideas about the world reflect our own internalized racism without us even thinking about it, and then also reinforce that narrative. So when we talk about, and one of the things I love was she's describing how we talk about neighborhoods. And we talk about neighborhoods and we say, oh, that's a dangerous neighborhood, or that is a, you don't want to, you know, the property values in that neighborhood are falling, or the schools aren't as good over as they are here. Those are all coded ways that white people talk to white people to tell them where the delineated neighborhoods of color are. And as soon as I heard that, I thought, because I was listening to it at first when she was kind of describing this and giving examples, and I was like, well, but you do want to, like, I search for housing based on schools. I've got kids. That feels like responsible something to do. And then you have conversations with other adults about, hey, how are the schools in that district? And that, and I, I think what she's saying, and I think it's important, is to say, look, these are parts of our lives that are racist that we do. And it doesn't make you a Klan member to recognize that you are engaging in this kind of racism. And you should, at the very least, be cognizant of the ways that our language around issues of race, to describe and to delineate borders of color within our neighborhoods and our power structures, just doing that is inherently racist. It is not, though, that does not make us like fucking evil alt-right assholes.
Yeah.
It does, however, create a responsibility in us to reflect on that and try to do better.
Yep.
And I think that this book is really important for pointing that out and for saying, look, if we strip away the moral component so that you get rid of the good, bad binary, which is an oversimplification that allows you to say, because I'm good, I can't be racist.
Yeah.
Right? That good, bad binary, I think, very much is a way for power to maintain itself.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to think of ourselves as bad. And we don't think of ourselves. I don't think of myself as bad.
But neither does David Duke, man.
But I recognize that I'm racist.
But neither does David.
What's that?
Neither does David Duke, though, right? Like,
right.
Nobody thinks of themselves as bad. But I recognize what you're saying, though, too, is like, you're not a bad person, but you do racist shit. And so do I.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think we have to get past that idea that it is a permanent reflection on our character in this way that stains us indelibly forever.
Yeah.
And rather is like, look, race is something we're born into. In this book, she talks about how from preschool age, children begin to develop their ideas and their narratives around race and about what racial preferences our culture like is teaching them. So we are all enculturated in it.
Yeah.
And like if we separate ourselves away from saying, look, I can't keep thinking in these terms because I'll always push back against them because I don't want to think of myself as bad. But I can think of myself as a good person who is racist and is working on that.
Yeah. And who's constantly working on it, right?
Who's constantly working on it. And that's harder.
Yeah.
That's a harder thing to say because nobody wants to raise their hand and say, I'm racist.
Yeah.
Right? But if you enjoy the fruits of racism, and as white people, you literally cannot avoid this.
Yeah.
Then you are part of a racist power structure. And so, and the author of this book even says, you know, she acknowledges, look, I will never escape this either.
Yeah.
This is an inescapable part of our enculturation. So I think by getting rid of this sort of like bland moral accompaniment to race that is often sort of tied to it, we're able to say, yeah, I will raise my hand and say, I am absolutely racist. I'm working on it. I'm trying to learn. Here are the ways I'm trying to get better.
Yeah.
Help me understand how to improve from there.
Yeah. And never just call it. You never get to dust your hands off and be like, I'm done with that. I'm post-racist. And there's a lot of people that's, and again, that's a very simple thing that many people try to do to try to get out of these conversations. They'll mention a thing that they did that somehow excludes them from this conversation. I marched in the 60s. I did a mission in Africa. I did this. So therefore,
I married a person of color.
Exactly. I am exempt from this conversation because I can't be racist because I did this one thing one time, which made it so I'm not racist anymore. And like, you know, racism is subtle. Racism is shitty and subtle, and it hurts people in ways that you don't notice. And that's the important thing, is that you awaken yourself to try to notice those ways in which you're being shitty, right? You know, you don't even know you're doing it. And you've got to try to wake yourself up. One of the things I see, and this is something I think is important to talk about, is that, you know, there is this concept, and you see this online all the time, especially, is like when somebody, a black person does something that's against a white person, they'll always be like, yeah, but black people can't be racist. Sarcasm at the /S or whatever, like black people can't be racist. And they have twisted this to the fact that they say it every time to try to devalue this idea. But the idea is that black people cannot be systemically racist because they don't control the system. they can be racially prejudiced. They can have racial prejudice against white people. They can, in fact, inflict racial damage because they don't like people because they have this prejudice. Absolutely, it can happen. You can be a white person and be in a minority in a group and receive that damage. But even if you are a minority for a moment, you're not a minority forever. And right. You're not a minority in perpetuity. And I think that there are some important things that get overlooked with that bland, shitty comment that everybody seems to make. They seem to forget that the system is what they're talking about when they're talking about racism. They're talking about a system that we're in. It's not an action.
Yeah. I love, there's a part of this book where she describes and really kind of just lays out in percentage terms just how white the systems of power in this country are. She describes, and I don't remember all the numbers, right? So forgive me, but you know, but I will tell you that they are overwhelming to the point where it's like in the upper 80s to upper 90s. And she describes like how many people are white in Congress, how many of the CEOs of our Fortune 500 companies, how many of the storytellers that inform us of the narrative that tells us who we are as a country in Hollywood that make TV, et cetera. How many of them are white? How many of the people that control how money moves around in this country?
Yeah, billionaires, you know,
the
et cetera.
Top leadership of billionaires. It's white all the way down, man. It's not like, oh, it's 60-40. It's, you know, it's like 93, 94, 99, like 89.
100,
like
100 in several, 100 in several cases. Yeah.
So when we look at stuff like that and we say like, well, all right. I mean, race is a system. Racism is a system. When we are operating on an individual level, I think there can be, like you just said, there can be prejudice. Absolutely. But that's a conversation that's really an interpersonal and intrapersonal conversation.
Right.
But
yes,
if we're having
exactly.
a social conversation, we need to have conversations about society and systems. And the systems in this country are racist systems. It is not an accident that, and she talks about how our myth of meritocracy, which is problematic for many, many
absolutely,
reasons.
Absolutely, yeah.
That our myth of meritocracy absolutely is a myth designed by white people to uphold white power.
Yes.
And it is. And all you have to do is look and say, who are the presidents of the universities? Look at any major system of power. Who are the CEOs of the Fortune 500 companies? What is the race makeup of our billionaires?
Yeah,
what is
man.
The race makeup of all the directors in Hollywood? What is the race makeup of, just name anything important. Name anything where power, social capital is created and maintained, where financial capital, where narrative capital are all made and maintained, and look at the racial makeup and tell me that those systems, those social systems are not racist. You simply can't do it unless you fall back on the racist meritocracy argument,
right?
Which is how people like to justify the same bullshit that they use to justify misogyny or anti-Semitism or any other horrible, like, prejudicial social shit.
Yeah.
Prejudicial is the wrong word, but like, you know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah. And people treat white privilege as if it's something that's given to you, right? So it's not given to you. White privilege isn't given to you. White privilege exists and you exist in that system. It's something we
that's
maintain.
Exactly right.
We maintain it. It's not like, you know, she gives an example of like someone walking through the world and without their knowledge or without any control, someone keeps on just shoving $100 bills in your pocket throughout your entire life. It's like, that's not how we live our life. We constantly maintain these systems of white privilege and we defend these systems of white privilege. And we use things like meritocracy as a way to try to defend them. But it's the same way that we defend the patriarchy, right? It's the same way it's defended through meritocracy.
Absolutely.
But it's like, it's a code to get away with maintaining it over and over and over again. It's not an accident that it's here. It's not an accident that white supremacy exists. It's not an accident. It's designed. It's been designed from a long time ago. She talks about some of the origins, in fact, in the book of, you know, racial science. We used to think that race, people of different races were just different biologically. And that's just not true. We've found out since then that biologically races, there's no difference in any biology across race in our world. That's not a thing that exists. There are a few adaptations that happen depending on where certain people lived for long periods of time that are only cosmetic. They're only cosmetic changes. They have nothing to do with the actual biology.
Like ability.
Yeah. And what happened was, is we essentially came at this, like our fucking founding fathers essentially came at this to try to maintain that slavery and that white supremacy that was built, that literally created this nation. One of the reasons what they want, one of the things that they wanted to do, they did the intelligent design thing. They had a conclusion, black people are inferior. How do we get there? Get us there.
Right.
And that's the science that they created. They made science based on that. They had the conclusion, they just needed things to line up to make it seem like this is the conclusion we want to get to. So we're just going to lay all our premises down and we're going to find specific premises that lead to this so that it looks like this is the actual answer. But we already had the answer when we started.
Yeah. I think one thing that you said too, that I want to sort of roll back to and point out is white privilege isn't something you can choose not to have.
Yeah.
You have it because you were born into the system white, right? So like if you are a white listener, you have white privilege. Does not matter specifically, like white privilege is, and she does a nice job of pointing out the ways that it's, white privilege is not the same as class privilege.
No.
You can have white privilege, and a lot of people try to like point out the ways they do not actually have white privilege, right? They'll say, oh, but I was born very, very poor, so I don't have white privilege. And it's such a race. That's actually a crazily racist thing to say, because what you're saying is, no, I'm like black people who are poor.
Yep.
You see, black people are poor and I'm like them because they are poor. That's a super racist fucking thing to say, actually.
Yeah.
You can't not benefit from white privilege. Now, some people benefit, like any system, right? Some people benefit more and some people benefit less, but you can't not have it. You can't, no matter how woke you are, you can't turn it in somewhere. I can't like walk up to the woke window and hand back my white privilege.
Yeah.
It's not possible.
Can't
to
get
do.
A new skin suit, man. Like, right. This is it. Yeah.
So I will live the entirety of my life reaping the benefits of white privilege. That's something I can't get rid of. So I need to acknowledge that that is true. And then I need to work to erode the amount of white privilege that I can erode within my lifetime. And you can only do that, and this is a big part of her fucking point, you can only do that if you're willing to have conversations about how your whiteness is a part of your identity and it is a part of your membership to a ruling class in this country and in many parts of the world. If we try to pretend that because we don't belong to a certain class, or because we have a different friend group, or because we've married into a relationship with somebody of color, that we can somehow walk up to the teller window and turn in our white privilege and no longer be seen as white and no longer reap the rewards of having been seen that way, we're lying to ourselves and we are not doing the job we need to do of self-reflection and social erosion.
Yeah.
And we have to do that work.
Yeah,
we can't do that work without recognizing our whiteness. And that's a huge part of this book. And I think it's a really essential part of this book that I had never thought of, Cecil.
Right.
I had never thought of that. I had always been the guy who, if somebody said, let's talk about race, I would have assumed we were going to talk about people of color.
Yeah.
Because I never would have considered
my too,
whiteness
man.
as a conversational element to like have to contend with. I've never been informed properly because I've taken up all of that social enculturation. I've soaked it in. It's the soup I swim in, man.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because like it's little things in your life that you had the privilege with that you might not have even noticed, right? Like if you're a white student versus a black student, there's a chance they're going to give up on you much sooner if you're a black student than if you're a white student. They'll just give like that. And that's something you don't have any control over and that you might never even consider or never even know. And that, you know, the problem is that we want to exempt ourselves from it because it makes us feel racist, right? And it puts us in an uncomfortable spot. And I think this whole book centers you in this really uncomfortable spot the whole time you're listening to it if you're white, right? If you're a person of color and you're listening to this book or you're reading this book, I imagine that you're, like she said, you're probably feeling a little vindicated about sort of like how shitty things really are. But, you know, you walk through your life as a white person with a lot of blinders on, and this book is it's an 8-hour uncomfortable conversation you have to have. And it's not there's no parts of this book where you're not constantly trying to think, am I like that? Do I do that? Should I? God, I got to stop doing that. And you should listen or read this book and constantly reflect. It should be a tool to reflect on how you're acting. You know, I'm curious, is there any parts of this book that you just like, you heard and you're like, no, that's bullshit? Because like, I know there's a lot of pushback on this book and I'm trying to find it, right? I'd love especially if somebody out in the audience hears this or reads this book and thinks it's all bullshit. I'd love to hear your argument about what piece of it was garbage. But I listened to it at this point, I think it's 3 times. And I was uncomfortable and certainly moved in places that I didn't want to be, but I never thought like, nah, that's bullshit.
No. I think you can't. I would be shocked if somebody said that is not true. That is not a truth. That is not a reality. I don't understand because fuck it. Of course it is. I want to tell a funny story about, maybe not funny, but a sort of maybe an illustrative story about one of the ways that like, I never thought of this as a racial experience, and this was an intensely racial experience. So I'm going to tell a story that will sound like it is not racial at all. And then I think this book has helped me understand how insanely racial this story is. When I was a kid, Cecil, one of my very favorite, I'm talking like probably 10 to 13, one of my very favorite things to do, and I did it all the time, was to shoot my BB gun. I had several BB guns actually. And one of them was this pump style, you know,
pump guns? Sure.
You could pump the shit out of them and you could get like a fair amount of speed out of one of those pump guns. And I absolutely loved this BB gun. I had a couple of them, but I love this one particularly. And I used to shoot this BB gun in my backyard just all the time. And then I also would meet my buddy Ryan, and Ryan had BB guns too. And so I would get my BB gun and I would ride my bike over to Ryan's house. And then we would go into the cornfield, and in the middle of the cornfield, there was a creek, and the creek had trees and shit that surrounded it. So it was like a little mini woods in the middle of the cornfield that you could walk down this like stretch of woods and creek and corn and stuff. And we would go down there with our BB guns and we would just plink at stuff. And then, you know, depending, sometimes we would actually shoot morning doves and then bring them home for his mom. And his mom would clean them and then they would eat them like squab or whatever.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's like a pigeon. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this was one of my favorite things to do. I did this as a kid all the time. I've always enjoyed shooting sports type stuff. And I think I started at a fairly young age, just really enjoying it. And I had such a great time. And that's the whole story. And that is an insanely racial story. And it's an insanely racial story because as a white person, I had the unbelievable privilege of being able to ride my goddamn bicycle around with a gun.
Yeah.
It's shaped like a gun. It has a scope on it.
It looks like a gun, man.
And then nobody once called the police. Nobody ever called the police and said, there's a kid with a gun. Nobody ever confronted me. Nobody ever said, and I didn't live out in the boonies. Yeah. I just lived in the suburbs.
Yeah.
I wasn't like out in the middle of fucking rural America where like, you know, guns and God and all that stuff. Like I was just this, I was a suburbs kid. You know, I just happened to be near a cornfield because it's Illinois. Like the fact that my childhood contained that insanely blithe element of my own personal safety.
Yeah.
Is intensely racial.
Sure.
And I never would have thought of that until, and this is something I reflected on reading this, is that there are so many times in my life that my life was insanely racially influenced in ways that I didn't think about. One more quick story that I think is like a way to contend with the way that racism creates these favored moments for white people. And you'll know this story, Cecil. When I was in college, I went to college in a town that was about an hour away from where I lived. And so, and I would come home oftentimes very late at night. And so I would be driving and I had this beat up old red Mustang that had been damaged all along one side. It was a total piece of shit. And I would be driving home at, you know, midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 in the morning. I've got an hour long drive. I'm driving in the rain and the snow. I had a headlight out half the time. I'm speeding. I got pulled over all the time. I got pulled over all the time. And I used to think it was so funny because I would get pulled over and I would never get tickets. I'd get pulled over and they would, you know, I'd roll down the window and they'd come up to the car and they'd, you know, look in the car and they'd be like, oh, you know, I'm just going to give you a warning. You know, you're going 10 miles over the limit in the rain with a fucking headlight out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they would just like, but they would see that I was white.
Yep.
They would, and they never pulled me out of the car. They never did it like, and I didn't drink, but they never did like a DUI thing. They never searched my car. They never called for backup. They never had their hand on their hip with their gun.
Yep.
It was always this like relaxed. In fact, it got to be so regular and mundane and unimportant to me that I would, that I had actually taped over Homer Simpson's face over my picture on my driver's license. And I would hand it and be like, oh, it's a recent photo.
Oh, that's so funny.
You know, like make jokes about it. Yeah.
Holy shit.
My ability to do that, that is an intensely racial story.
Jesus, you'd have been taken to fucking jail if you're a black guy put a fucking photo like that. I'll just really quickly, when I was a teenager, sometimes I hung out with people that were less than desirable. And these kids that I was hanging out with at the time were driving around and one of them had one of those CO2 pistols, right? And these are all, we're all white kids, you know, and they had a CO2 BB gun pistol.
Those look real as hell. I had one
and
of those.
Driving around down in the city I was in, and they were shooting at stuff on the side of the road. So they'd like shoot at like, I don't remember them shooting at like people, but I remember them shooting at like a house or a car or something, you know what I mean? Like little things like that and like signs and whatnot. Someone called the police on us. I was in the backseat of that car and they were shooting and stuff. I don't remember doing it myself. I wasn't that kind of kid. I don't remember doing that particularly, but I was hanging out with kids that were doing it. And so they were shooting at stuff. And then one of them hands the gun back to me and says, put it under the seat. And so I shove it under the seat. And a cop walks up as I have a gun, Tom, in my hand that I am shoving under the seat as a police officer who knows that children have been driving around a town for the last hour brandishing a pistol. And I have it in my hand. And he's like, hey, man, give me that BB gun. And I gave it to him. He's like, guys, you can't be doing that. And they're like, we're sorry. And he's like, I got to take this. All right, so long. And that was literally it. That was literally the entire conversation, man. I didn't, nobody pulled me out of a car. Nobody yelled at. He didn't even raise his voice. He was just like, guys, he can't be. It's like it was like he was disappointed. And that was it.
He's like your dad. Just
that
like,
was it, you know, man.
What? Like, you're supposed to empty the dishwasher. And would you have ever thought before this book, would you have ever thought that was a racial story?
No, you know what? And there's a lot of times, there's a lot of things in your life that you don't realize it until afterwards. But yeah, you're right. You look at it now and you're like, holy shit, I am so lucky that. You know, because if you were black, you could have been killed, like literally shot to death. They do less to a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, I thought about that when Tamir Rice was murdered. I thought like, oh my God, I couldn't count how many times my BB gun was my favorite thing for like years. 150 times I was at a park with it.
Yeah.
Or in a field with it,
man.
Riding my bike with it, or whatever. Like that kid got fucking murdered for something I did with literally no consequences.
Every day, you know, like for entire summers. Yeah.
I mean, it's just crazy.
I want to talk about the anti-blackness chapter. And this is an interesting chapter. We're talking about anti-blackness and how this is communicated across all different kinds of media, and. One of the things is that she talks about very much in this particular chapter is the misunderstandings with affirmative action and how that gets blown out of proportion and how we look at affirmative action as this demon, as this awful thing. And then they like the problem is that most people don't even understand really what it was. And she lays out exactly what it was. And then she talks about who benefited, which was white women. And you're just like, and you're like, holy shit, what the fuck? Why were people so crazed about this? But if you could even bring it up today and it'll freak out. But my favorite part of this chapter, Tom, is her absolute fucking evisceration of The Blind Side. When she
Oh my God. Do you remember watching that movie for Everyone's a Critic?
Oh my God. It's so, I don't know.
Do you remember
I don't think we covered it. I don't think we covered it.
We didn't?
I thought we did.
I thought we had a whole conversation about how it was racist years
ago. I think we did cover it and talk about it, but I think we've watched it separately. I would watch that movie again to talk about how racist it is.
I remember being like, holy mother of God, this is so racist.
Comment below in this Patreon thing if you want us to watch and talk about The Blind Side. I'm willing to do it.
I would do that too.
I'll do it.
So I couldn't believe, I love the evisceration because it was so validating. It's one of those movies where you're like, how did this fucking movie get made?
She won an Academy Award, dude.
Oh my God.
It's so unbelievable. The way, and seriously, it's 3 minutes of tape that she eviscerates this movie. And it is so unbelievable that this isn't like not a modern movie. This isn't a 1950s movie. This isn't a 1970s movie. This isn't a 1980s movie. This is a 2000s movie.
Dude, it's 2009. 2009. The Blind Side came out. And I remember this movie so clearly. And she points
out, we had a black president, didn't we?
Yes. 2009, we had a black president and The Blind Side came out. And you're like, how the fuck does this movie get made? And it gets made because it's a beloved kind of movie. You know, this is like a movie that, like you said, Sandra Bullock, that's America's sweetheart, man.
Yeah.
We don't think of Sandra Bullock as like engaged in and propagating. And I'm sure she doesn't either. And that's an important part of this book, is that your intentions are not what define whether or not we have engaged in racism.
Yeah.
Right. You can set your intentions aside and say, all right, you didn't intend anything. That literally makes no difference. What happened, though? What actually, there's a story she tells, and I think it's in the same chapter. There's a story she tells where a teacher, if I remember right, a teacher is talking to a couple of black students, and she prefaces one of her statements by saying, girl, and then goes on to make her statement. And the young lady that she's talking to takes exception to being called like, girl.
Did you just call me girl?
Like, racial overtones right? And then, but this woman is like, look, I call everybody. It doesn't matter. It's a term I use thoughtlessly. She didn't say that, but it's like, it's a term I use for everybody. Because I use for everybody, my intentions were not racist. And it's like, that doesn't matter.
Yep.
That makes no difference. That you didn't know that this had racial overtones is ignorant, and you should be disabused of your ignorance so that you can do better.
Yeah.
And you should still apologize, even if your actions unintentionally caused racial damage.
Yeah.
Because it should have been a learning opportunity, right? And I will tell you a story of a learning opportunity I had centered around race a few years ago. And it was an embarrassment in my career. So, and I think I told you this when it happened. We had one of the managers that works for me was setting up a training, and she had set up this training and part of the training was service related, customer service related. And as part of the training, she took a clip from Mad TV, and it was a Burger King style clip.
Sure. Yeah.
And it is a heavily, and Mad TV, I don't know if you remember Mad TV, but Mad TV dealt a lot in racial stereotypes and racial jokes and racial tropes. And this clip she played was, Cecil, it was so horrifyingly inappropriate to play. And I had no idea she was going to use this clip. I didn't vet her materials. It didn't occur to me. And the reason it didn't occur to me is because I trusted her intentions. And I know who this person is. And I know that this person
would
never... She's
a good person. And there's a binary... Well, right. There's a binary, good, bad binary, where you're like, she's good. She wouldn't do anything bad.
Yes, this person would never. And I do, and I 100% fully still believe that this is a good person who has only ever had good intentions. Nonetheless, she chose a clip to play for this training for 500 people that was horrifyingly insensitive and caused me to have to, you know, not have to, but gave me an opportunity to realize that I had made a mistake by assuming that intentions would translate into action.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, met with the people that were affected And I had an opportunity then to listen to those people and to put a plan of action in place to make sure that they felt heard and that these things wouldn't reoccur. And that was just the, but what I didn't do is say, you know what? Her intentions were good. Look, I know who she is. She's got a good heart.
Yeah. Don't take this too seriously. You're Come wrong. On. It's not a big
You're
deal.
Wrong.
It's right. not a big deal. And that's the, that's again, that's stopping the conversation. It's yes. making it so you don't have these learning moments. You know, we get emails all the time. Not all the time. We didn't, it used to happen a lot more than it does now, but we used to get, you know, you try to be more careful. I think we, you know, as time goes on, you just get better at doing comedy. You get better at doing, you know where the edge is, you know where you can go and where you can't go. And, you know, there's been times that we've crossed the line and done the wrong thing or said the wrong thing, or even when it wasn't a joke, said something that was inappropriate that we didn't realize was inappropriate. And I think Yep. you've always got to be ready to listen to the people who are offended by that. Listen to the people who are affected by that. It's not that it's like, you and this is the common line. Oh, you can't say anything anymore. That just means you're not willing to change who, like the things that you're doing that are hurting other people, right? I recognize that there are some things that I've listened to people and I've said, you know what? I don't think that crosses a line. There's been a couple times in my life where I've been like, I'm sorry, sure. I don't think that crosses a line. And then Same. we've gone our separate ways. There was someone who was upset that I talked about John Lennon's death in our Citation Needed that we did about the killer. And I disagree. I think, you know, like they never once said anything bad that we said. They just said, you shouldn't talk about his death. And I was like, well, I disagree. The end. That's right. The end of that conversation. I think you should talk about it. But you know what I mean? Like, but if there is something that I said that I think, you know, I can learn from, I want to try to take that opportunity at any point that I say something, then I can learn from it. And I think, you know, there's going to be people in the world who are always going to fight this. The reading this book isn't going to help them. Like they're not, they're right. always going to be the ones who are going to fight this. They're always going to be the shitty people that are going to be like, you can't say anything anymore. Burr, 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 burr. You know what I mean? Like those are those assholes on YouTube that are like the yeah. worst and that, you know, tweet at people, rape threats or whatever. They're just gross and bad people. And for them, the intention has always been bad. So it doesn't matter, right? So it's not yeah. like these are good intention people that you might be able to convince. These are bad intention people that are shitty. So those aren't people that this book is made for anyway. This book is made for people who are good intentioned, who want to be better intentioned and want to be better at paying attention to other people and changing their behaviors so that their intentions and their actions all match. You know what I mean? Because sometimes you yes. just do something yep. that you just don't, you're not paying attention to because you're not in it. And I think this book does a real good job of making you stop. It's just it's like almost like, you know, like how some people find their center when they meditate, like understanding this stuff is sort of making you stop at the right time to be like, is this a learning moment for me? And maybe I should take this as a learning moment rather than being defensive about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, the phrase that I like kind of came up with when I was listening to this book that's very similar to that, Cecil, is that our goal should be reflection rather than reaction.
Yeah.
And when I think there is a tendency, and I am not immune to this, of course, I think there's a tendency when we are criticized to be reactive.
Yeah, be defensive, yeah.
And that's human. Like we're all human beings. Like we don't like to think of ourselves in this good, bad binary on the bad side. Because I think race for so many years has been taught as part of this good, bad binary. We've also been sort of taught that we can't make racial mistakes without like having our intentions be impugned.
Or yeah.
We can't make racial yeah. mistakes without, you know, or have racial ignorance be exposed without feeling this deep sense of shame and guilt. And that is just not useful. That just doesn't move the ball forward.
Yeah.
What we have to do is not be reactive. And if you are reactive, reflect on why you've been reactive.
Yeah, man.
Right?
Yeah.
And then spend the time saying, wow, I got a lot of criticism. I got this point of criticism on this. I need to reflect on whether that's warranted. I need to reflect on what points they're making. How can I do better? I do that as often as I can, and I am still not great at it.
Right.
I know that I am not great at it. I know that there are things that, like my initial knee jerk is this very reactive, and maybe I'm speaking mostly for me, but like I know that like in many circumstances, my first instinct is to be very knee jerk about sure. a lot of things. It's yeah. like, I, and I, I had good intentions. Like, I can't believe you would impugn my intentions. Sure. I'm doing my best over here.
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, well, fucking get that out of your system.
Yeah.
Then calm down. And I mean this because it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay to have that reaction and calm down and think about whether or not you can do better.
Yeah, man.
And that reflect rather than react should be. And I think this book does a nice job of giving us tools on how to do that reflection in ways that in my mind, at least from the two times I read it, I feel better equipped to make those reflections.
Me too.
And I genuinely feel better equipped. You know, it's interesting because I was trying to think of other, like I told a couple of stories that I thought were really racial. You know, I think it's interesting, like, to look at media and see, like, you know, what are the big shows out there? Like, oh, let's watch Friends. It's five white people. Like, oh, let's watch Seinfeld. Not a person of color on Seinfeld. I'm talking about these because they're old shows. I know I'll get called a boomer, but we're rewatching them at home now. So, like, when you turn on the TV and you look at, like, these stories that we're being told about what America is, we're being told white stories, man. Those are racial stories. Those are absolutely racial stories.
Yeah, I think back to all the times that I've been defensive, especially when you're talking about the show too. Like, I remember years ago when I was corrected about, you know, using trans language in a wrong way. And I was corrected and I got defensive. You know, I was like, because I was thinking about my intentions, right? I was thinking about, you know, I've always been an ally. How dare you, kind of. And, you know, you got to stop and recognize, you know, there are people that will hear it, correct you and not be upset with you. You know what I mean? They're not upset with
you. Most people, man.
They just want to correct you so you don't do it again. And you should be gracious if that comes to you. You know what I mean? Like, and I always try to catch myself too, because you want to be as gracious as possible. But representation, you know, when you're talking about representation, this came up in the last book that we read. We're talking about all the different stories that are just boy-based. You think about all the stories that are boy and white boy based. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's insane. The few stories that slip through might be white girl based, right? You get once in a while, you'll get a person of color story. So that's why, and I recognize how important our representation is. You know, it changes people's lives. They talk about success rates of kids. You know, some of the success rates that kids have, if they see someone in a position of power that is their race at a young age, talking about like a school teacher or something, they have a way better chance to root that is of their own race. They have a way better chance to succeed. Just if that happens, I mean, it's simple, but it doesn't take a lot, but it takes it, you know, you've got to be conscious that those things are important and that representation is important.
You know, I know I talk about this idea a lot, and I think it's just because I went to school and got an English major and just decided that I would make that important, even if it's not. But like, I do think that the stories we tell about who we are deeply, deeply, deeply important. I really do. I will always believe that. And, you know, it's interesting to look at some of the controversy around like Disney characters. So like Ariel in The Little Mermaid, there was recently cast as a black woman playing the role of Ariel. And there was an enormous amount of uproar. There was an enormous amount of uproar because people did not like the recasting of this character, who, by the way, is a mythical character. It is not necessary to the canon of this fucking myth that this person have white skin. That is, it's literally meaningless. But this created and drummed up this insane amount of controversy because that's a moment of white challenge. That's a moment where the de facto default assumption of who good people and heroes are as being white is being challenged. And when those things get challenged, there is this sort of social cultural pushback. And I think that pushback is the sort of reaction rather than reflection writ large, where people are like, oh, I don't want to contend with that. I don't want to contend with this. I don't want to, because I want all of my heroes to be white. I want all of my default assumptions about who the good people are, who the powerful people are, who the doctors are, who the, you know, all of it. I want all of that to stay white. I'm not racist.
Yeah.
But I'll push back anytime it's not white.
Yeah, man.
And it's like, that's super fucking racist. Like, that's just, if the only stories we tell about heroes and like high up positions and people in power are, and, you know, if all those stories center whiteness, then we are having a racial conversation. We are 1,000% having a racial conversation.
Yeah.
We're just refusing to acknowledge the conversation.
Yeah. What did you think of this book overall? I thought this book was, I think this book is very worthwhile. And I think it's worthwhile reading. What did you think about it?
Yeah, man, I love this book. I read it twice. And I think both times I was able to get something from it. If somebody's got a criticism of the content of this book, I would be very, like you, interested to hear it.
Me too.
Because I found this book deeply, deeply compelling. And it did give me many moments of pause and consideration. I think this is a book you should put on your bookshelf. And I think you should be proud to have this book on your bookshelf. And I think you should take it down more than once in your life. I will go back and reread this
book. Yeah, me too. Me too.
I will consider the lessons that I learned from this book because I think they're an ongoing conversation. And I think that's another thing that this book really kind of taught me is that race is an ongoing conversation. And it is something that I need to continually confront in my life in order to do the work that I think I am required to do of eroding the social position of race.
Okay, so rate the races right now, if you can, just really quickly. All right. Thank you, everybody. All our patrons, we genuinely 100% think, you know, thank you so much for being patrons. We hope you guys enjoy this. Comment below if you want us to watch The Blind Side, because I will. I'll do it. I'll watch that fucking movie and I will tear the shit out of it if you want us to do it. And let us know if you have any comments. If you read the book, if you had a different experience, let us know. You know, definitely. I'm up to talking about this again. You know, if this moves on to another conversation, we're gonna probably talk about very soon what the book's gonna be for next month. We got to sort of get out a poll soon this month to try to figure something out for next month. So look for that in your Patreon inbox. And again, thank you so much for being patrons.